From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Nell Larson. So back in December, an unusual number of bald eagles began showing up dead and dying around northern and central Utah.
The cause of death had the scientists at the Division of Wildlife Resources baffled. Was it a virus, a bacteria, or a chemical in the form of, say, a pesticide or herbicide?
Or was it a heavy metal like lead or mercury?
Joining us to help explain what eventually it was determined to be and why will be Mark Hadley. He's a spokesperson from the Division of Wildlife Resources.
And then in the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with Alan Tequiraz, author of The Monkey's Voyage, The Improbable Journeys That Shaped the History of Life. The book was just released on the 7th of this month.
Really? Okay. That's going to be a really interesting conversation. And speaking of which, if we have time, we'll talk a little bit about that chemical spill you've all heard about in West Virginia last week. How much was released? How it got into the Elk River? What was done to clean it up? And what in the world is methyl cyclohexane methanol anyway? And why does the coal industry use it?
Very interesting.
Exactly.
Looking forward to the summary. Of course, you can join in on our discussion today by posting your questions or comments to our wall on our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, or emailing us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
The environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Contrary to popular belief, getting pregnant can be difficult. For some couples, it can be quite a challenge. The OBGYNs at Park City Specialty Clinic are there to help you find solutions for pregnancy on your terms. The appointment number is 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Have you ever wondered how many calories you burn while you sleep, or how much your organs weigh, or how you can lower your healthcare costs and prevent many diseases? Live Well Center at Park City Medical Center has those answers and more. Whether you're hoping to lose weight or gain a competitive edge, Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment today for a healthy lifestyle evaluation, now covered by most insurance companies. Visit livewellcenter.org/PC for more information.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. My co-host Nell Larson, as always.
And, That's right.
Let's get started talking about this issue with bald eagles. Back in December, hunters and farmers across five counties in northern and central Utah began finding the normally skittish raptors lying listless on the ground. Many suffered from seizures, head tremors, and paralysis in the legs, feet, and wings. Additional birds passed, bald eagles passed away. The Division of Wildlife Resources attempted to try to figure out what was going on. It took them a little while, and they figured it out. And joining us by phone is Mark Hadley. He is a spokesperson with the Division of Wildlife Resources. Mark, thanks for joining Nell and me on This Green Earth this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, let's start. You know, we got a little background. I think most of us know kind of the setup of the story. These bald eagles were becoming ill, and many died. And this started back in December, correct?
That's correct. Yep, right around the start of December, Chris, is when we, you know, had the first eagles brought into us that were sick and started finding some dead out in the wild, too.
Now, was it limited to just eagles, or were there other carrion eaters like, say, turkey buzzards or turkey vultures that were also impacted?
Yeah, just bald eagles. Those are the only birds that were brought in sick or that we found dead.
So explain to us why that is. Why bald eagles?
Yeah, That's a good question. I'm not 100% sure why just bald eagles, not maybe some other birds that play, you know, that prey on carrion. But anyway, those are the only birds though that were turned in.
Okay, so give us a sense then. What did the DWR do from there to try to figure out the cause of the problem?
Yes. Well, what we did is we turned a number of carcasses into a few went up to the Utah Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory up in Logan, up at Utah State. But the bulk of the birds went to the National Wildlife Health Center back in Madison, Wisconsin. So we sent these carcasses back, and they were ran through a wide variety of tests. The lab workers were looking for all kinds of different things, mm-hmm. trying to determine what might have killed these birds, and were able to rule out a whole bunch of things. But one thing that stood out to them, one thing that the birds all tested positive for, was West Nile virus.
So explain to us exactly, you know, kind of what is West Nile virus? What are the, you know, symptoms or the things that it does to the carrier?
Yeah. Well, what ends up happening to birds that are affected by it, infected with it, I guess, is, first of all, the birds, they have a hard time standing. It's very difficult for them to stand. And they start to develop some paralysis, so that they can't lift their wings. And then they start to have head tremors, too. So it really, I mean, it affects the birds in a variety of ways, very serious ways. And these symptoms all manifest themselves before the bird finally dies. And the sick birds that we took into the rehabilitation centers, usually within anywhere from about maybe 2 to 3 days on average, these birds would be dead after being brought in. It took their lives pretty fast. They all developed these similar symptoms before, though.
Okay, and how many have died to date? Do you have a most recent number?
Yes, I do. I check with Leslie McFarland, who's our wildlife disease coordinator for our agency, and as of yesterday, 47 eagles had died, and we had 4 eagles that were being treated at rehabilitation centers. So that's the current numbers as of yesterday. Hmm. The good news in all of that is we've noticed that the rate of eagles that are being found dead and that are being brought in sick has started to decline, though. The rate, when this fall first started back in December, you know, we were having, it was like every day we would have a dead eagle found or a sick bird found. And so it's starting to decline slowly. And so that's some good news in this unfortunate situation.
Right.
So when you say that some of these eagles are being treated at rehab facilities, that brings up a couple questions. One, is every bird that does every bird that gets the disease die? And second, how do you treat a bald eagle that's infected with this virus?
Yeah, Neil, that's a really good question. I don't know all the different things that the rehabilitators, all the different things that they do to try and help these eagles out. I'm not certain exactly how they treat them, not every eagle dies that gets West Nile. We do have some eagles that the rehabbers have currently that have, you know, been with them for a while. My understanding is the recovery period though is quite long. It will be months before, if these eagles survive, it'll be months before the rehabilitators will know whether or not the eagles can be put back into the wild or not. But again, I'm not certain all the different things that they do to treat for West Nile virus. I'm not positive on that.
Right. So let's talk about how they contracted this. Where did this virus come from?
Yes, and you know, that's something, Chris, that's one of the many unanswered questions that we have right now. Our best theory is we know that we had eared grebes die of West Nile virus on Great Salt Lake this fall. And because all of the eagles that have gotten sick or have died have all been found within flying distance of the lake, and by flying distance I mean that the eagles haven't been any farther from the lake than up than Box Elder County to the north or Utah County down to the south. So they've all been within flying distance of the lake. So our theory is that the eagles flew to the lake, which is an area that they head to a lot, the eagles in that area anyway, head to a lot to feed this in the winter, and fed on these dead grebes that had died from West Nile virus, and that's how they contracted the disease. There's really no way for us to prove for certain that that's what happened, but that's the theory that makes the most sense when you look at where the dead and sick eagles have been found, and the fact that we did have a large die-off of air grebes this year that died from this very same thing that the eagles are dying from.
Okay, so that's your working theory right now.
Yeah,
eared grebes, and for listeners, or now you can. What is an eared grebe?
That's a great question, Chris.
Make sure.
Yeah. A lot of people that they have never heard of a bird like that. What they are, they're a water bird. They migrate through the state of Utah in tremendous numbers. We have upwards of 2 million. Eared grebes that come through Utah, they come from southern Canada and Montana, come through Utah in the winter on their southern migration to the Salton Sea, which is down near San Diego, down in Southern California. And this is such a great place for them to stop that they stop here and spend a few months here, about two months before they take off and continue their journey south. And so that's what an eared grebe is. It's a water bird that migrates through the Great Salt Lake in tremendous numbers.
So are any other birds or animals, I guess, for that matter, at risk of being infected if they eat these eared grebes?
Well, I believe so, Nell. Obviously it's affected the bald eagles. But what's interesting that you asked earlier, have we seen other birds, of prey that feed on dead, or feed on carcasses and things. And we haven't had anything else brought in, which we're happy about. It's interesting, though, that hasn't occurred. But I would think, Neil, that other birds of prey could be affected by this if they happen to feed on these birds, on these dead grebes.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Mark Hadley. He's a spokesperson for the Division of Wildlife Resources. We're talking about the bald eagle illnesses and deaths that have occurred over the past month. And right now the working theory is that it's mostly West Nile. They died from West Nile virus. And the working theory is that they contracted West Nile from eating infected eared grebes. So, Mark, 2 million eared grebes, if 99% of them are healthy, 1% is, that's 20,000 grebes that could have contracted West Nile or sick from West Nile. So that's a big number. And like Nell says, you guys are still trying to figure out, may other raptors or other carrion feeders come infected, coyotes or other animals, land-based animals that might see, hey, an easy meal. The effort continues to try to figure out, but it's really interesting that it's West Nile, because initially that was something that you wouldn't think would be a suspect in the middle of winter, right?
Right. Yeah. No, you're exactly right, Chris. There's a couple of very interesting things here too. First of all, as far as we are aware, there's never been there's never been a case of eared grebes dying from West Nile virus. Huh. And yet we've confirmed that that's indeed what's happened. So that's a first. Also, there's never been a documented case that we're aware of this many birds dying from West Nile virus. That also is a first. So there's been a lot of firsts that have happened. And also, we're trying to learn more. We're very curious about how long West Nile virus can persist in a grebe carcass. The grebes started to come to the state in October. That's when they start to arrive. There was a lot of mosquito, activity, of course, in October, and even through the middle of November, there were a lot of mosquitoes, which are the typical carriers of West Nile virus, out and about in the marshes. We don't know if the grebes got West Nile virus from being bitten by mosquitoes here in the state, or if they brought it with them.
Right.
You know, and so anyway, we've got a lot of, there's a lot of unanswered questions. There's a lot of things related to this that are first-time things that researchers have just never seen happen before.
So along those lines, is there a plan going forward for more research on this to try to figure out what is happening or how this got started?
Yes. Yes, Neil. I know one thing that we want to do is we want to eventually have all of the eagles that die tested. We want to first of all, make sure that we know how many of those eagles died from West Nile virus, and every single one that's been tested so far has tested positive for West Nile. So that's one thing we're doing. We're also testing additional grebes. We're collecting additional samples, and we want to test those birds to learn the same thing. Did they all die from West Nile virus, or did some of them die from something else? We're collecting water samples from the areas where the grebes died. We want to learn more about, can the virus persist in water out in the Great Salt Lake? And is the salinity of the lake, it tends to preserve carcasses a little bit longer than maybe freshwater might. We want to learn a little bit more about that, too. Is it allowing the virus to persist in these carcasses maybe longer than it would persist somewhere else? We're also, I know we would like to also obtain, and I don't know if we've gotten these yet or not, we want to look at the brine shrimp eggs out in the lake and see if we can learn anything from them, you know, and are they carriers of the virus? So there's all kinds of things that our folks are looking at right now and trying to gain more information about.
Okay, and I believe you said earlier that the birds were tested for a battery of suspects, whether it was bacterial or viral or chemical too, and one suspect that I initially thought of was methylmercury.
Uh-huh.
Were the birds tested for the presence of high levels of mercury?
You know, I'm not 100% certain on that, Chris. Hmm. What Leslie shared with me is she said that they were tested for, you know, toxic. Well, a lot of basically what you just mentioned, Chris.
Yeah.
You know, chemicals, poisons, lead poisoning, bacterial infections, viruses. I don't know on the methylmercury if that was something they were tested for or not. I'm not certain.
Okay.
I apologize. I just don't know.
Okay.
So, Mark, you kind of gave us a picture of the eared grebe and where they, you know, came from and where they're going to and how long they're around the Salt Lake. Can you give us that same picture for the bald eagle? How much longer will they be around?
Yes. Neil, thank you so much for asking that question. Yes, I can. Bald eagles typically start migrating into Utah in November. And what they're doing is they're coming here to winter. A lot of eagles spend the winter here. When the population peaks, we're at about 750 to up to upwards of 1,200 bald eagles that are here in the winter. But they start to come in November, and the numbers typically peak about the middle of February. So it's a migration that happens over kind of a fairly long period of time. The numbers typically peak about the middle of February, and then by the end of March, they're typically gone. They're flown back north to nest. So they migrate in over sort of a 2 to 2.5 month period of time or 3 month period of time. Then their numbers peak, and then pretty quick they turn around and they're gone. After their numbers peak, they're not here for very long, and then all of a sudden, you know, spring's arriving, and they head back north.
Okay. Well, I'll say this. If I was an eared grebe, the last place I'd want to winter is in the Salton Sea.
Oh, Lord.
That shot at California there, Southern California, but what I know of the Salton Sea, that's not a very – that. You know what? You guys should be going testing the waters in the Salton Sea, too, while you're at it, or talk to California about it. Mark, where can people go to learn more about your continuing research on this?
You know, our wildlife disease coordinator has been so busy with the research that I'm not aware of really there being any place right now where that research has been posted. But I do know that she is going to be working with the folks at the National Wildlife Health Center to publish some findings. It's going to be in a journal. I forget the title of the journal, but that I know that they're anxious to get some of this research out there, because we've had people across the nation asking questions and wanting to know more. And so I don't think that research is out there yet, will be published.
All right. Well, like you say, there is a lot of firsts going on with respect to this issue and this story, and I'm sure we haven't heard the last of it, and we'll probably be in touch with you or Leslie McFarland going forward to learn more.
That's great. I look forward to that, Chris.
Well,
thank you.
Mark Hadley, spokesperson with the Division of Wildlife Resources, thank you again for taking the time to talk to us on This Green Earth.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate so much you having me on your program. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Let's take a little break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll get on our second guest.
That's right. We'll be talking to Alan DeKiraz, the author of the new book called The Monkey's Voyage, The Improbable Journeys That Shaped the History of Life.
You don't know.
That's
do
right.
Not want
you
to
don't
want
to miss this.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage services and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Recycling in Summit County is improving. The trick to remember? Recyclable materials go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and topics and concerns and our connections
and impacts upon the environment. And sustainability and impact.
That's Nell Larson. I'm Chris Cherniak. We're waiting for our next guest to call in. When we do, we'll get him right on the air. But in the meantime,
we have some
fun facts on eared
grebes. Yeah, we have some facts and figures on the eared grebe. There's been some discussion around the radio station. What exactly is a grebe and how do you pronounce it? Well, you do say grebe. And there are a few different kinds of grebes in Utah, but the eared grebe is the most common kind.
Is it? Okay.
And it breeds all over the state.
It doesn't have an ear.
No just noticeable ears, not that. But it does have really distinct bright red eyes. So there's your identifying feature.
Okay, all right. And somehow, Nell, you can try to segue from
I'll just
eared grebe
smoothly
to,
segue from that right into our second guest. It's a natural fit. On the phone with us now is Alan DeKiraz, and he's the author of The Monkey's Voyage, The Improbable Journeys That Shaped the History of Life. And by training, he's a biologist. He lives in Reno, Nevada, and is faculty at the University of Nevada, Reno. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So you just released this book a few days ago. Congratulations.
Thanks.
So why don't you give us a little bit of information about your background and your research that led to you writing a book like this?
Well, I'm an evolutionary biologist, and mostly I actually study snakes. So, in fact, I was studying the behavior of garter snakes, sort of the evolution of behavior, and that took me down to Baja, California to collect some of these garter snakes. And it turns out that these garter snakes live on the very tip of the Baja, California peninsula and nowhere else on the peninsula. And then they're also found across the Sea of Cortez in sort of what you might think of as mainland Mexico. And so that kind of got me into this question about how could something be in two places that are separated by a sea or an ocean? And that's kind of what that was about maybe like a dozen years ago that I actually took that trip. And that sort of led into this whole thing about thinking about how things might, or explaining distributions that are broken up by oceans, like the garter snakes or like monkeys living on both sides of the Atlantic, things like that.
And so tell us, I guess, a little bit about, you know, the theory that has been, that has always been accepted for these similar animals living in different parts of the globe. And then about the theory that you present in your book.
Yeah, well, it's not, I wouldn't say it's my theory. I mean, it's in fact, this idea of things crossing oceans goes back to Darwin. And it's kind of gone back and forth. Like Darwin, you know, made a strong argument that plants and animals had dispersed across oceans to get to places like Hawaii. And in fact, he did these experiments showing that, you know, plant seeds could survive for a long time in seawater. But then kind of switched over, or a lot of people started, you know, that's really impossible. And so they started theorizing that there were land bridges connecting these various places, even places like Hawaii, oddly enough. But then more recently what happened was that people, once continental drift became established as a fact, then people realized, oh, that's a great explanation for these things. So, you know, you can imagine that, you know, there were these supercontinents like Pangaea and then Laurasia and Gondwana that were just these giant continents with animals and plants living on them. And then when they fragmented by continental drift, the organisms just sort of went along for the ride. Mm-hmm. And now so what we see are these related organisms separated by oceans. So so that happened basically. Continental drift became a, sort of an established fact in the 60s.
A very convenient theory, you know.
Yeah, well, and it's the truth. You know, I mean, I totally believe in continental drift.
Right.
Right.
And like any reasonable scientist. But the question is whether continental drift really does explain these distributions. So clearly continental drift is a geological fact. And certainly it's true that plants and animals did drift with the continents. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all of these weird distributions that we see today can be explained by continental drift.
Okay. So, it's a distribution post-continental drift, or a distribution in addition to continental drift that is occurring. Well, one I've heard is that sometimes you have distribution as a function of storm systems. Hurricanes, cyclones can pick up seeds and insects and birds and distribute them from one continent to another via storms or weather systems. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. That's almost certainly true.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's a little weird and has made people kind of reluctant to accept these ocean crossing explanations is that you don't often actually see them happening. So, you know, because they are really rare events, you know, in some cases, you know, for a particular group, it might be an event that happened once in 50 million years. So the chances of actually observing that sort of event are really slim. But we can kind of infer from a variety of evidence, a lot of it now is molecular evidence, that these things must have happened. So it's not so much that we're actually seeing them happen because they're so rare. It's more that the sort of preponderance of evidence forces us to believe that they had to have happened.
So give us a couple examples of these strange cases where there are two pretty closely related species literally an ocean apart.
There's a bunch of kind of weird examples. One of the most striking ones is there are these carnivorous plants. They're little sundew plants. And there's a species that's found on the top of a mesa in northern South America, on the top of one of these tepuis, which have been sort of called lost worlds because the top of the mesa is sort of isolated from the forest below or the forest or savanna below. But anyway, there's a species of carnivorous plant that's found on the top of one of these mesas, and it turns out that its closest relatives all live in Australia. And And the South American one probably didn't separate from those Australian ones in an evolutionary sense until about, you know, on the order of 10 million years ago. So that was long after the continents had drifted apart or had separated.
So would we call that 10 million years like relatively recent history?
Yeah, so in sort of, you know, the larger scheme of things, that's very recent. And the continents were already, you know, pretty much in their modern configuration at that time. So what that means is that an Australian sundew must have somehow traveled, you know, halfway around the world to get to this one place in South America. So that's one weird example.
Are there any theories of, like, how this happened?
Well, in that case, what the authors of that study suggested is that, you know, maybe it was something that Darwin had actually talked about quite a bit, which was that seeds might have been stuck on the feathers or feet of a bird, and then the bird, you know, traveled halfway around the world, and the seed came off of it, or seed came off of its feet, and that's how it happened.
And like you mentioned, this maybe only has to happen once every 50 million years, so it's
right.
It doesn't have to happen frequently.
Right, and in a lot of these cases, you know, it clearly didn't happen frequently. Like in the case of the monkeys crossing the Atlantic, that seems to have happened once.
Tell us that story.
So
that's kind of the title story of the book, so to speak. And it's a case where there are monkeys in the New World, obviously. You know, things like spider monkeys and squirrel monkeys, and like actually over 100 species. And there are monkeys in the Old World. Things like baboons. And so the question is, how did that happen? What explains that? And so again, the separation between the New World monkeys and Old World monkeys based on genetic evidence is, again, reasonably recent. It's not as recent as that sundew plant. It's more like on the order of 30 or 40 million years. But again, that suggests that the route they took was across the Atlantic. And in that case, obviously, they're not going to be stuck on a bird or anything. They probably rafted across on some kind of natural raft of earth and vegetation.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Alan DeCuros. I'm sorry if we pronounced that incorrectly, but
that's pretty close.
And he's the author of The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. And we're talking about the theory that he presents with quite a bit of new research in this new book. I'm talking about the distribution of species across oceans and around the world.
Here's what I'm curious about. Is it possible for plants, or insects, birds, et cetera, to evolve independent of one another? You know, to actually show up in one part of the planet and another part of the planet, and not independent of any linkages? You know, can you have plants develop in South America and the same type of plant develop somewhere in Africa?
That's an interesting question. And so for the monkey case, earlier in the century, in fact, probably up even in like the 1940s or 50s, the last century, I should say, people were really reluctant to believe this idea that monkeys had crossed the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead, one of the theories that they came up with was that monkeys had actually evolved separately from more primitive primates.
Mm-hmm.
And because they just couldn't believe that, you know, so if monkeys were all closely related, the New World and the Old World ones, that sort of required this Atlantic crossing.
Right.
So to get around that, some primatologists, people who actually study primates and, you know, clearly believe in evolution, were saying that, oh, the New World monkeys must have evolved separately from some primitive primate, because that would have not required that monkeys cross the ocean. And that's not completely implausible. In that particular case, it doesn't hold up if you, you know, look at the DNA similarities between New World and Old World monkeys, as well as anatomy. It's really clear that monkeys are closely related. You know, all the monkeys came from a common ancestor that was a monkey also.
Right, okay.
But in other cases, that might be the case. So you might see two things in separate parts of the world that just look really similar, but actually evolved that similarity separately.
Right, okay.
But really, the cases I'm talking about in the book are not like that. So they're cases where, you know, there are things that are separated by oceans, but clearly are, you know, relatively closely related to each other also.
So we just got a question from somebody else who has taken a look at this book, and they said, why is it that monkeys on some continents have long tails and not on others?
Oh, that's a good question. That's probably a little bit beyond my expertise, since I'm not a primatologist. But yeah, so I mean, it is sort of interesting that some of the New World monkeys, not all of them, have these long tails that they use sort of as a fifth limb. You know, they can grab onto things with it, and so it's really that really has only evolved in some New World monkeys. So a lot of the New World monkeys don't have that, and none of the Old World monkeys have that characteristic. And yeah, I'd be hard pressed to tell you exactly why that evolved in one place, but not another. But you know, that's sort of a common thing that happens in all sorts of groups, that you know, some unique feature evolves in one place but not another.
That's incredibly interesting. So when did this theory of continental drift being the, I guess, distribution method for these species, when did that theory start coming into question, and when did scientists start to look at these other potential answers to that question?
Okay, yeah, so that's an interesting question. That's actually a key part of the book. In kind of like the 70s and 80s is when this idea of continental drift explaining these weird distributions kind of really became dominant. And it never completely took over. There were always still people who kind of questioned that at least as the dominant explanation. Everybody believed that that was happening to some extent. But for a lot of people, that became kind of the dominant sort of default explanation. So anytime you saw one of these distributions broken up by oceans, you explained it by continental drift. And then what happened really was that people started looking more at molecular data, especially DNA sequence data, and started doing a lot of these so-called molecular clock analyses. And what those are is that you look at genetic differences between species, like, say, the difference between New World monkeys and Old World monkeys. And from the genetic differences, you can tell more or less, I mean, at least roughly, when those two groups separated from each other in an evolutionary sense. And so in a sense, you can tell, like, how old the monkey group is. And from that information, you can sometimes eliminate continental drift as an explanation. So, for instance, in the monkey case, monkeys, from that kind of molecular clock analysis, are not old enough as a group to have been affected by, you know, the separation of Africa from South America. So you can't use that continental drift explanation to, you know, explain why there are monkeys on both sides of the Atlantic. The group is just too young. And it was those kinds of molecular clock analyses that sort of revolutionized the field. And, like, basically in the last 20 years, so all of this DNA data has accumulated, and people have done, you know, literally hundreds of molecular clock analyses, and many of those have shown that things had to cross oceans, that you know, groups are too young to have been affected by continental drift, basically. Hmm.
So it seems like there are a fair number of these species where, you know, scientists are finding the same thing, that they probably didn't end up there because of continental drift. Give us a few more examples of things we might be familiar with.
Okay, let's see. One is that things that you'd be really familiar with. Well,
we don't have to be too familiar.
Yeah, there are lots of examples. It's kind of hard to sift through them all in my head quickly. But big flightless birds like ostriches and, you know, emus, and on New Zealand, it's the kiwis. and rheas in South America. So that was considered a sort of a classic example where the distribution had to be explained by continental drift, because these are big, flightless birds. So people were thinking, you know, there's no way they could have got across an ocean.
Sure.
And that's an example that it's probably a combination of both continental drift. So what it looks like now is that that example can be explained partly by continental drift, but not entirely. And so it's looking like some of those, there have been some ocean crossings in that group. For example, at least some people believe now from the evidence that Kiwi ancestors reached New Zealand by crossing from Australia rather than just drifting with New Zealand as it broke away initially from Australia.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a couple minutes left and we have to wrap up, but I have to add that there are all kinds of really fascinating stories in the book and that it's a pretty scientific, you know, technical topic mm-hmm. to take on, but I thought the book was pretty easily readable.
Good to hear.
good. So, Alan, is there anything else that we've missed that you want to add before we have to wrap up? And where can people find the book?
I know. I think, you know, you can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I know that. I don't really know the details of where it's being sold, but it's, you know, it's definitely around in general. I guess one thing I would add that's actually come up in conversations with people is that, and I know that your show is actually, you know, often focused on environmental topics. So, you know, some people have sort of brought up this idea that, well, if these ocean crossings, natural ocean crossings, have been so common, why are we so worried about introductions of species by humans all over the planet? So,
One of my favorite topics, Alan.
So the notion is that, well, if this has been happening all through the history of life, why are we so worried about it now? Because it's just kind of the natural state of things. And I think that that's kind of a very dangerous view to take, because what we're doing now is sort of so much greater in magnitude than what happens naturally. Like, basically, we're transporting things across oceans and you know, letting them establish in new places so much more frequently than happens naturally, that it's a completely new ballgame. And we're also transporting things that would almost never be able to cross oceans on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So a good example would be like pigs and goats, which, you know, sure. humans have transported all over the world. And those sorts of animals almost never are able to cross, you know, large expanses of ocean on their own. So it's real. What we're doing is both much more rapid and kind of different in quality than what happens naturally.
Right.
It's a really great point. It's something we talk about relatively frequently, is invasive species and new species and their impacts on
right.
sure. our environments, our native ecosystems.
Only nowadays, instead of it taking, you know,
50 million years
or 1,000 years, it takes about 4 hours. You know, one jet airplane, you're one flight from transporting a snake or a bird or some other type of reptile from one continent to another. I mean, the lionfish is a great example I use in Florida. That's a South Pacific reef-dwelling fish that was brought over. It's an aquarium fish, and it got introduced through either humans or storms or so. Into the waters of the Bahamas, and it's game over in many
right,
ways
right.
from there in a matter of years. So that you're right. That what we can distribute is, you know, FedEx in comparison to what the Earth distributes naturally. So, hey, Alan. So thank you again. The name of the book is?
The Monkey's Voyage, The Improbable Journeys That Shaped the History of Life. And, Alan, the website is themonkeysvoyage.com. Is that right?
I think it's actually something like monkeysvoyagewordpress.com.
Okay. Well,
we will straighten that out, and we will post it on our Facebook page and get that up on the web. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, we got some news items and a little heads up on what we're going to be talking about this Thursday, Sundance, our
That's
special
right.
Sundance
you
show.
You get to hear from us not once, but twice this week in a two-hour special this Thursday.
You can barely stand it. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back after these words from our underwriters.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage services provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more, currently nearly 6 million pounds per year. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
All right.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's my co-host, Chris Cherniak, across the board.
Here.
And we're back to talk a little bit about some drinking water issues that are being seen in West Virginia.
Yeah, just a few minutes. Again, this is a story that has been splashed across the headlines
for the
last 4 days. Last week, there was a release of a chemical into the Elk River, which is a tributary to the Kanawha River in the Kanawha Valley in Charleston, West Virginia. As a result of this release of this chemical, about 7,500 gallons is suspected to have been released from this storage tank and distribution area, which is a mile and a half upstream from the intake to the water treatment plant serving Charleston. Okay, so the
not
Charleston,
a great location.
Yeah, so 300,000 people went out without drinking water for approaching a week. The concentrations of this chemical have come down enough that the water restrictions are being released or removed
in some areas.
In some areas, it's a slow process there. What I want to do is just take a couple minutes. This chemical, 4-methylcyclohexane methanol, what is it? It's used in the coal industry. It's interesting. It's used to clean coal. Now, not all coal. There's 97% of the coal that we use in this country is called steam coal. It's used to burn, right? That's the typical idea we have of coal in this country. We burn it to produce electricity. But a small percentage of it is called metallurgical coal. That's because it has enough metals embedded within it that it's used in the steel manufacturing industry for coking. It's called metallurgical or coking coal. This coal has to be clean for that process. Normal steamer coal can be dirty. You got dirt, grit, sand on
it,
burn
it
all. It just falls out with the ash. Metallurgical coal requires it to be clean.
Explain what that means, clean. What is
clean means clean literally coal? All the dirt and impurities have to be washed off it. And
so
I guess
it's like a purer product.
You need more than water to do it.
And surprise.
The process involves the coal being washed by this methyl cyclohexane methanol. It separates the dirt and the grit and the sand and the other impurities from the coal, so you have a clean,
pure
coal, metallurgical coal. So here's the interesting thing. Before they used this chemical, they used diesel fuel. They washed the coal in diesel fuel. Okay, so I guess we can consider this a step up.
Step up from diesel fuel.
Yes. So anyway, that's what this chemical is used for. The big issue is it harmful? How harmful is it? No one really knows because like so many other thousands of chemicals that are introduced to our distribution chain in this country, very few of them are tested.
Right.
Prior to them going out into the market. And this one doesn't have a lot of rigorous testing. So they set a concentration of one part per million to say that's safe versus non-safe. And that's what they're trying to get down to. So,
and even though in some areas they're down to this one part per million, they're still, you know, the people, you know, are running the water from their taps. And at one part per million, they can still smell. They can still get an odor. So, You know, that would definitely be a hard decision to make if yes. you're a resident. Is yeah. this really safe to bathe in?
Right.
Is it really safe to drink?
No, yeah, it could be detected below. Yes, so that's a problem too. It's slowly fixed. Here's the thing. The tanks is interesting. The state of West Virginia doesn't require formal inspection of tanks that are distribution tanks. Now, the manufacturer of this chemical, they require inspection by the state. But once it goes into the tanks and storage and distribution centers, no more inspections. So this area hadn't been inspected since 1991. That's a problem. The other problem is
yeah.
the tanks and the piping and the gauges and the valving, the plumbing associated, they're at least 20-some years old. So these are old, old tanks that are giving way. So it doesn't surprise me.
Right.
No. Okay.
Shouldn't be too shocking.
Yeah, it shouldn't be shocking. It is shocking that it's a mile and a half upstream from the drinking water inlet.
And we'll follow this issue.
Yes.
And...
Okay. We've got a couple minutes. Let's talk about our Sundance show.
Yeah.
This Thursday.
It's this Thursday. It's a live broadcast from Whole Foods. So we'll be sitting in the cafe area of Whole Foods.
Yeah. Like we all have been doing
for the last couple of years. Several years.
This year we'll bring jackets and blankets and space
toe hand warmers, toe warmers.
It gets a little cold in there, but that's okay. And we're going to be talking to a number of different directors of different documentaries, including Marmato. That's a portrait, a documentary of the Colombian gold mines.
And this is going to be a really interesting one. It's kind of an environmental documentary, but it's also a social documentary looking at what happens when these huge corporations come into a tiny Colombian town. How does that impact the people and the
right.
environment?
Yeah.
Should be a good one.
The dreams and aspirations associated with the gold versus the realities.
Yeah.
Another one is Dinosaur 13. I'll be speaking to the director of that documentary.
As well as the paleontologist that
really?
Found the dinosaur.
I did not
so
know
I'm a little
that.
Bit excited about that.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's the one line here. The world's greatest dinosaur discovery right here in Utah.
That's right.
Is that it? Okay. So we'll be speaking to the director of that. And then another film is the director of Alive Inside, A Story of Music and Memory.
That's right. And we'll also be speaking with the director of programming of the entire Sundance Film Festival. We'll talk about a few other films with him. And we'll be talking to KPCW's own Rick Braff about some of his stories of past Sundances and his views on upcoming films.
He's got lots of great stories.
That's right.
And we're going to talk to him about it. So that's all Thursday starting at 9 o'clock, big two-hour show, 9 to 11. Stay tuned. Let's take our last little break for underwriters, and we come back. We'll wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up. Let's start by thanking our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Of course, again, you can join us on Facebook with your thoughts and ideas and feedback on our shows.
That's right. And give us a like if you like our content.
Yeah, please. KPCW,
yeah.
This Green Earth. Again, thanks to our guest, Mark Hadley from the Division of Wildlife Resources about eagles, and
Alan DeCuros, the author of The Monkey's Voyage, The Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life.
That's it. Thanks again for joining us. And join us again this Thursday at 9 a.m. It's our Sundance Film Special. We'll see you then, Nell.
See you, Chris.
This is KPCW, Park City.